behind her. She decided that she must act instead on her heart's knowledge of her own humanity. So she did a simple thing. She sat down toward the front of a segregated bus and refused to yield her seat to a white man. Rosa Parks had prepared herself for this moment. She had studied strategies of nonviolence at the Highlander Folk School and had served as secretary of the Montgomery chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. Her act precipitated a public transportation boycott led by Martin Luther King, Jr., resulting in a federal court decision that bus segregation laws were unconstitutional and giving impetus to the civil rights movement. But when great moments in history are reconstructed with the intentionality that comes only with hindsight, we forget the lone individual in the moment of her decision and the anxiety or doubt she may have felt. And when we forget that, we forget our own power. Miles Horton, founder of the Highlander Folk School, tells about the time he introduced Rosa Parks to Eleanor Roosevelt. Mrs. Roosevelt asked, "Have you been called a communist yet, Mrs. Parks?" When Rosa answered yes, Mrs. Roosevelt said, "I suppose Miles told you when you were at Highlander that you'd be called a communist." Rosa told her I hadn't warned her, and Mrs. Roosevelt criticized me for that. I said, "If I'd known what she was going to do, I'd have told her. But when she was at Highlander, she said she wasn't going to do anything. She said that the white people wouldn't let the black people do anything, and besides, the black people hadn't been willing to stick together, so she didn't think she'd do anything. I didn't see any reason to tell a person who wasn't going to do anything that she'd be branded as a communist. If I'd known she was going to start the civil rights movement, I'd have told her." And Rosa said, "Yes, he told me later on, after I got arrested." Obviously, Rosa Parks overcame her own doubts and decided to act. But she did so with no guarantees that her training would pay off, that nonviolent strategies would work, that her colleagues would share the risk with her, or that she would spark a national uprising. In fact, other people had committed similar acts with no results except punishment. Had Rosa Parks sat there calculating the odds of making history, she might well have moved to the back of the bus. The decision she made was rooted in the only sure place we have, no matter how shaky we feel. The deep inwardness of an integrity that tells us we must do this thing. Why did Rosa Parks stay in her seat that day? The best answer comes in her own words. "People always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired, but that isn't true. I was not tired physically, or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. I was not old, although some people have an image of me as being old then. I was 42. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in." With these words, Rosa Parks calls us to the simple, non-strategic humanity of her act. She was simply tired. Tired in her heart and in her soul. Tired not only of racism, but of her own complicity in the diminishing effects of racism. Tired of all the times she had yielded her seat to whites. Tired of the self-inflicted suffering her collaboration had brought on. Concealed in that analysis is a truth about movements that is often ignored. In deciding to live divided no more, the individual goes beyond criticizing an institution and becomes self-critical as well. By choosing an undivided life, I implicitly acknowledge that the institution would not have had power over me if I had refused to go along with it. No longer are those people or that place my immediate problem. My immediate problem is me and the silent conspiracy I have had with the institution, the conspiracy that allowed that institution to rule my life. To choose the undivided life is to put flesh on the pogo principle. We has met the enemy, and it is us. The moment we decide to stop being our own enemy, we free ourselves from institutional constraints and gain power to confront the institution. But here I must speak with care about the relation of movements to institutions. We think of movements as hatefully and self-righteously hammering away at evil structures until the structures fall. And we contrast them, often invidiously, with the slow, steady, responsible process of caring for an institution and working for change from within. But that portrayal can easily be reversed. People who confine themselves to organizational infighting often become obsessed with internal enemies and possessed by the demons of institutions. People who start movements do not do so because they hate an institution, but because they love it too much to let it descend to its lowest form. That is how Rosa Parks felt about the institution of American democracy that had permitted racism to flourish. Democracy was not to be despised and replaced with some fantasy of raceless totalitarianism. It was to be rescued from its degradations and called back to its highest purposes. Having recognized that the enemy is not simply out there, but first and foremost in here, in our personal collaboration with evil, Rosa Parks was able to act from love rather than hate. The love that wants to redeem the enemy that can be found in us as well as around us. What does all of this have to do with educational reform? As I have understood the nature of movements more clearly, I have realized that I meet teachers around the country who remind me of Rosa Parks. They love education too much to let it sink to its lowest form, and, whether they know it or not, they are sparking a movement for educational reform by deciding to live divided no more. These teachers remember the passions that led them to become academics, and they do not want to lose the primal energy of their vocation. They affirm their deep caring for the lives of students, and they do not want to disconnect from the young. They understand the identity and integrity that they have invested in teaching, and they want to reinvest, even if it pays no institutional interest or dividends. These teachers have decided that teaching is a front-of-the-bus thing for them, even though their institutions want it moved to the back. They have stopped blaming institutional conditions for teaching's low estate, and have stopped conspiring with those conditions as well. Instead, they act in ways that honor their own commitment to the importance of teaching. What these teachers do is often as simple as refusing to yield their seat on the bus. They teach each day in ways that honor their own deepest values, rather than in ways that conform to the institutional norm. Sometimes they take risks of a more public sort, promoting alternative visions of education in faculty forums where pedagogical policy is made. What drives the decision to live divided no more, with the risks it entails? How do people find the courage to bring inner conviction into harmony with outer act, knowing that when they do, the force of the institution may come down on their heads, risking the loss of image or status or security or money or power? The difference between the person who goes to the back of the bus and one who decides to sit up front is probably lost in the mystery of the human heart, but in Rosa Parks and others like her, I see a clue to an answer. When you realize that you can no longer collaborate in something that violates your own integrity, your understanding of punishment is suddenly transformed. When the police came to Rosa Parks on the bus and informed her that they would have to put her in jail if she did not move, she replied, "You may do that." It was a very polite way of saying, "How could your jail begin to compare with the jail I have had myself in all these years by collaborating with this racist system?" The courage to live divided no more and to face the punishment that may follow comes from this simple insight. No punishment anyone lays on you could possibly be worse than the punishment you lay on yourself by conspiring in your own diminishment. With that insight comes the ability to open cell doors that were never locked in the first place, and to walk into new possibilities that honor the claims of one's heart. Communities of congruence. The decision to live an undivided life, however powerful its motivation, is at first a frail reed. It needs continual reinforcement, because the person who makes it soon begins to feel anxiety and self-doubt. Naturally so, for we live in a culture that tells us a divided life is sane, but an undivided life is foolish at best and irresponsible at worst. The undivided life is foolish because if you let others know what is going on inside, they may reject and injure you, so it is better to keep your feelings tucked away. It is irresponsible because if you reveal your inner truth, you can no longer perform your duties dispassionately, duties like teaching from a detached, objective stance. So it is better to play your role and keep personal truth hidden away. In the second stage of a movement, people who have chosen the undivided life but still feel shaky about it come together in communities of congruence whose first purpose is simply mutual reassurance. In company with others who are on the same path, these people are helped to understand that normal behavior can be crazy, but that seeking integrity is always sane. In the movement sparked by Rosa Parks, these communities of congruence found a home in the black churches. Throughout the South, churches served as gathering places for people who needed to know that they were not alone in choosing an integral life. But the churches offered more than physical space where people could meet. They offered conceptual space where the substance of the movement could be developed and sustained. Here is the second function of communities of congruence. To help people develop the language that can represent the movement's vision, giving that language the strength it will need to survive and thrive in the rough and tumble of the public realm. When discourse begins among people who have recently freed their souls, the language feels fragile. The fragility that comes when we talk about dreams in a society obsessed with practicality, or about community in a society obsessed with competition, or about risk-taking in a society obsessed with playing it safe. People who use such language, the language of the heart, need a place to practice it, to grow accustomed to it, to have it affirmed by like-minded people before they speak to a larger audience that may range from skeptical to hostile. When Martin Luther King Jr. went to that larger audience with images of his dream or the mountaintop, he was drawing on a reservoir of symbols that had been tapped time and again in this movement's communities of congruence. Such images were not the private property of King, the great orator. They were the lingua franca of ordinary people. Through constant use in the black churches, they had gained accessibility and power. Those churches played a third role characteristic of communities of congruence. They provided a training ground where people living undivided lives could develop the skills and habits necessary to take their values into the larger world. I once had a vivid experience of this. I was visiting a community in rural Georgia and was invited to worship with a small African-American congregation. I arrived in time to attend the adult Sunday school class and found myself in a room with three other people who were preparing to discuss a Bible passage. To my surprise, they ran their class by Robert's Rules of Order, and each of them had a role to play. One was the chairperson, one was the secretary, and one was the parliamentarian. Afterward, I shared my puzzlement with the friend who had taken me to church, himself a resident of the area and a frequent attendee. Why had the class practiced such formality when there were only three people present? Wouldn't it make more sense just to sit and talk? He said, "You don't understand what you just saw. This church is a place where people who have been deprived of a role in governing our society have a chance to learn some tools of governance. Someday these people will claim their rightful role, and when they do, they'll have the capacity to perform it." Communities of congruence are vital in educational reform, but creating them is made difficult by the privatization of academic life. I am often reminded of this fact when I visit a campus for 2 or 3 days. When my opening talk is over, someone will come up to me and confide, "I agree with everything you say about teaching, but I am the only person on campus who feels this way." At the end of the second session, 3 or 4 more people will approach me, one by one, to share the same secret. By the time I leave, I have met 10 or 15 people who share a common vision for education, each of whom is certain that he or she is alone on this campus. More than once, I have tried to introduce those people to one another, hoping to plant the seeds of a community of congruence that might take root and grow in that place. Such communities emerge when 2 or 3 people gather and make a commitment to each other. I have seen this happening especially among women in academia, who are engaged in 2 movements at once, one for good teaching, another for the place of women in the academy. But if communities of congruence are to develop on a significant scale, they may require structural support. Black churches provided that support in the civil rights movement. They were standing structures that embraced a large and concerned constituency, built on a system of symbols that provided a rhetoric of liberation. Are there structures in the academy that could shelter communities of congruence for teachers who want to live divided no more? There are no standing structures with the credibility and power of the black churches, but that does not mean that the game is lost. I am aware of at least two educational structures that have some movement potentials and are already serving such purposes, however modestly. One is the growing number of teaching and learning centers on campuses large and small. The programs at these centers often focus on training in technique for faculty who want or need it. In the process, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not, these centers offer committed teachers a place to find each other, talk with each other, and discover ways to provide each other with continuing support. A second structure is the growing number of regional and national associations that have been organized around the values of deep reform. In the world of higher education, I mean groups like the Association for General and Liberal Studies, the American Association of Higher Education, and the Professional and Organizational Development Network in Higher Education. People who feel isolated on their own campuses can attend gatherings of groups such as these and return home encouraged that they have allies and friends, albeit in distant places. People involved in movements often have more friends far away than they have at home. The reform agenda that is so inspiring on a national scale turns out to be threatening locally. But when I meet visionary teachers who feel isolated on their own campuses and ask them what they have done to make their vision known, the answer is often nothing, which is why they are isolated. The lost will never be found until they send up a flare. There is only one way to find friends close to home, one way to plant a seed from which a community of congruence might grow. One must make visible one's decision to live divided no more. Visibility is not easy because it may bring recrimination. But when we declare our values in a visible and viable way, we will sometimes be amazed at the way allies gather around. Going public. The strength of a movement's second stage is that like-minded people gather in community to reinforce fragile beliefs. But there are two ways in which this strength is also a weakness. When we talk only to each other, and not to a larger audience, no movement can emerge, and we are more likely to fall into delusion and error. When a movement goes public, not only does it have a chance to influence others with its values, but it also meets challenges that compel it to check and correct its values. There is so much soul force in making the decision to live an undivided life, and so much reinforcement when people who have made it come together, that the shadow of self-righteousness is almost certain to emerge. The only way to minimize the shadow and maximize the light is to expose the movement to public critique, and to take the critique seriously. When I explore the movement model with others, it is often criticized for being value neutral. The model can, for example, describe conservative movements that the critic dislikes, as well as liberal movements that he or she applauds. Worse yet, any model that starts with divided no more easily applies to fascist movements in which people decide to bring their actions into harmony with the evil that is in their hearts, such as the Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, and the Aryan Nation. My first response is that the arena of social change offers no safe harbor for the purity of thought and action so dear to intellectuals. There are no guarantees that movements will be deployed toward ends I regard as worthy, just as there are no guarantees that organizations will pursue such ends. The life of the world is messy, a source of suffering as well as creativity, and if we want to work for change, we must learn to live with the mess. But my second response is to make a crucial distinction between a movement, whether I agree with its aims or not, and a pseudo-movement. The distinction hinges on a movement's willingness to enter this third stage and go public. A fascist movement refuses to go public, and in that refusal it degenerates from being a movement to being an exercise of coercive power. The leaders of authentic movements willingly go public and engage in give and take, knowing that this public dialogue is a path toward the authority that comes from understanding and persuasion. But in a fascist movement, the leaders have no interest in public exposure and critique. Indeed, fascism depends on shutting down the public realm so that fascist values cannot be challenged and countervailing power cannot be generated against them. In a totalitarian society, the public sphere is shut down by main force. No gatherings in public places, no voluntary associations, no free press, no politics worthy of the name. But even in societies like ours, where the public sphere is attenuated but still open, pseudo-movements find ways to evade public scrutiny and accountability. I think, for example, of the radical religious right and its stealth candidates who do not reveal their true beliefs until they get elected to public office. Even when the public realm is open, it is possible to evade public scrutiny, at least for a while. But when a group does so, it ceases to be a movement of moral authority and becomes a bald manipulation of power. When the current movement for educational reform is viewed through the lens of going public, we see that a movement can grow so slowly, so organically, that we are scarcely aware of its impact. Though the movement for educational reform has yet to achieve major goals, the images and symbols of educational reform are alive and well today in the public arena. Books are written on the subject, and some become bestsellers. Speakers roam the land planting seeds of change in workshops and convocations. New associations advance the cause in national and regional gatherings, and faculty who feel isolated on their own campuses seek them out as oases. Old-line national associations take up the cause as a path toward their own renewal. Even more important, the movement for educational reform has been joined by publics beyond the walls of the academy. Parents, employers, legislators, and columnists call for more attention to teaching and learning, calls that are insistent and sometimes effective. Here is a case in point from a field not normally regarded as a hotbed of reform, accountancy. Many accounting graduates hope for and find initial employment in the Big Six, the large international public accounting firms. These partnerships hire 10,000 graduates a year and donate more than $20 million to support higher education. In 1989, the CEOs of the top international accounting firms jointly issued a paper detailing what they felt the professional needed from educators. The paper described in some detail the desired knowledge and skills they wanted to see in the graduates they hired, which included the social and cultural context of organizations, creative problem-solving, effective communication, and the ability to work in groups with diverse members, and the ability to withstand and resolve conflict. The CEO's report stated, "Passing the CPA examination should not be the goal of accounting education. The focus should be on developing analytical and conceptual thinking versus memorizing rapidly expanding professional standards." In their white paper, the large firms pledged $4 million over 5 years to help create the changes they sought in the curriculum, contingent on the condition that they be used for the design and implementation of innovative curricula and new teaching methods. When the language of pedagogical reform becomes common coin among the leaders of the Big Six accountancy firms, who then use their considerable clout to press business schools to change, one can see that the movement has made tracks, however quietly and unnoticed. The way in which the educational reform movement has gone public reveals how untidy reality is compared to my model of movement stages. For example, educational reform has achieved a scale in stage 3 that is disproportionate to the scale of stage 2. There is more talk about reform in the public realm than one would anticipate from the small number of communities of congruence in the privatized world of traditional education. But this discrepancy, rather than discrediting the model, shows how valuable models can be, for deviations from the model point us to things that require explanation. Perhaps the discrepancy between stages 2 and 3 results from the fact that ferment for reform is coming less from teachers in traditional schools than from people who teach in other settings, especially in the world of business and industry, where at least half of the post-secondary education in this country is now being done. Most major corporations have in-house universities to help their employees keep pace with rapid change in society, technology, and markets. For example, each of the Big Six accountancy firms operates its own education division to provide continuing graduate-level education to its professional employees. It is not uncommon for a firm to manage over 1 million contact hours of training each year. Nor is it uncommon for these non-traditional programs to employ pedagogies more inventive than one can find at most colleges and schools. The energies of this huge sector of non-traditional education could help drive educational reform if we knew how to harness them. But that will happen only when educators in traditional settings break through their privatization and make common cause with educators from alien worlds. In the words of Marge Piercy, it will start when you say we and know who you mean, and each day you mean one more. The need for that breakthrough is illustrated by a problem I find on almost every campus I visit. Teachers who use non-traditional methods feel thwarted by the traditionalism of their students' parents, and some of their colleagues. Stop doing this touchy-feely stuff with students. Cover the field. Make them memorize the facts and show them how to compete. If you don't, you put them at a disadvantage in the real world of work. The irony is clear. The real world of work is the source of much pedagogical experimentation and change, precisely because conventional top-down teaching does not prepare students well for the realities of that world. But some students, some parents, and some academics are caught in a cultural lag. They need to hear the news. Of course, they will not believe the news if it comes only from persons who teach. It must come from authoritative voices in the world of work itself. But many educators even, and perhaps especially the most innovative, see people from business and industry as enemies, not allies. We rarely ask or trust them to help us deliver the news that pedagogical change must happen if students are to succeed in the real world. If we who teach would understand how a movement works and try on a movement mentality, we might find it easier to make common cause with people in the public realm who can help the movement along. Some of them are within easy reach and would gladly join hands with us. They are alumni of our institutions and members of our boards of trustees. As we seek allies among employers, we will learn that not all of our reservations are unfounded. In the business world, openness to pedagogical reform serves the single purpose of improving the bottom line. Not all our potential allies will understand, let alone honor, the aspirations of the liberal arts, though some clearly do. Not all will subscribe to the central premise of this book, that good teaching cannot be reduced to technique, for business is even more enamored of technique than education is. But making common cause in a movement does not require partners whose vision matches our own. As we link arms, we will find ourselves tugged in dangerous directions, but because our arms are linked, we will have the chance to do some tugging of our own. Making common cause opens the possibility of teaching and learning across previously alien fields. As a movement goes public, the identity and integrity of its participants are tested against the great diversity of values and visions at work in the public arena. We must stay close to our own integrity in this complex field of forces where we can easily lose our way. But we must also risk opening ourselves to conflicting influences, for in that way both the movement and our integrity can grow. The heart's reward. The fourth and final stage reveals the full trajectory of those movement energies that were generated in stage one, when isolated individuals abandoned the logic of organizations and decided to live divided no more. Those energies, which became communal in stage two and went public in stage three, now come back to where they began, returning to alter the logic of the very organizations from which they first sprang free. I say alter rather than transform or revolutionize the logic of organizations because the outcomes of most movements are modest. They rarely resemble nirvana. Most movements do not overturn the prevailing order, but make incremental adjustments to it, on the scale Thomas Merton suggested when he said, "We do not need to adjust to the world. We can adjust the world." Movements are more likely to fine-tune reality than to give rise to a brave new world. Even more humbling, these modest alterations, once they are institutionalized, eventually become the ancien régime, the unbrave old world, They become the shape of the institutional resistance against which the movements of the next generation must press. But they are alterations nonetheless, and if the movement has sound principles, the alterations will also be sound, at least for a while. Movements have the power to alter the logic of organizations, because an organization is, at bottom, a system of social sanctions. Do this and you will be punished. Do that and you will be rewarded. As long as an institution controls the reward system in a given arena of activity, such as teaching and learning, it has power over the lives of everyone who wants to engage in that activity. But as soon as those people decide that the institution's punishments are irrelevant, which is the key to stage one, and the movement evolves an alternative system of rewards around the activities those people value, which is the key to stage four, the institution's power starts to decline. When that happens, institutions often awaken to the need for change, lest the action go elsewhere and they become irrelevant to people's lives. For example, when virtually all post-secondary education in the United States was done by traditional colleges and universities, those institutions had no need to change. Anyone who wanted to be a student or a teacher was compelled to play by their rules. But now that half or more of our post-secondary education is being done by business, industry, and the military, traditional higher education is feeling the pinch and opening itself to renewal. What are the alternative rewards that push traditional organizations to rewrite their logic? As a movement grows, it offers intangible but powerful rewards at every stage of development. In stage one, there is the reward of learning more about one's identity. In stage two, the reward of being in community with supportive and like-minded people. In stage three, the reward of living a more expansive public life. As a movement grows, the meaning one is unable to find in working for an institution is found in working for the movement. The affirmation one does not receive from colleagues in one's organization is received from movement friends, and careers that no longer satisfy the soul are redirected toward ends that the movement has inspired. Movements offer material as well as spiritual rewards. Some people make modest incomes from working for the movement itself, as organizers, for example. Working for the movement can have economic payoffs elsewhere. More than a few academics devoted to educational reform have published books and articles on the movement and its aims that helped earn them promotion or tenure in traditional institutions. Ultimately, as a movement grows, conventional organizations are more and more likely to create spaces where movement-style work can be done and paid for. 40 years ago, people working openly for racial diversity in the workplace often had a hard time getting paid jobs of any sort. Today, many organizations pay people to be diversity specialists, working for racial and gender harmony and justice among employees. 40 years ago, women and African Americans were often treated as unsuited for scholarly life. Today, black and feminist scholars are often vigorously recruited. Ultimately, the diverse rewards offered in this final stage of a movement are reflections of the same elemental reward, the reward that comes from living an undivided life. In stage one, people see that no punishment anyone lays on them could be worse than the way they punish themselves by conspiring in their own diminishment. In stage four, they see that no reward anyone offers them could be greater than the way they reward themselves by living their own truth. When substantial numbers of people embrace this understanding, institutions are forced to negotiate, for they no longer have a hammerlock on people's hearts. The alternative rewards offered by a movement may seem fragile compared to the raises, promotions, and status that organizations bestow on loyalists. So they are. Integrity, as the cynics say, does not put bread on the table. But people who are drawn into a movement generally find that stockpiling bread is not the major issue in their lives, not because they have all the bread they want, but because they have a more basic hunger. They understand that human beings do not live by bread alone. The way of the movement is an alternative to organizational gridlock and the despair it breeds, an alternative with historical precedent and power. But having spent this chapter mapping movements and examining their implications for educational reform, I need to voice a disclaimer. Even with map in hand, we may cling to the organizational approach for reasons more sinister than ignorance of another way. We sometimes get a perverse comfort from insisting that organizations offer the only path toward change. Then, when the path is blocked, as it often is, we can rest in resentment and blame it all on external forces rather than take responsibility ourselves. Part of us prefers being hopeless to taking the risk of new life. If we believed that new life were possible, God knows what we might be called to do. It is not uncommon for academics to be driven by this death wish, even, and sometimes especially, the most idealistic among us. The most vigorous resistance to the movement option may come from visionaries who have been defeated on one front and are too weary to open another. I am a teacher at heart, and I am not naturally drawn to the rough and tumble of social change. I would sooner teach than spend my energies helping a movement along and taking the hits that come with it. Yet, if I care about teaching, I must care not only for my students and my subject, but also for the conditions, inner and outer, that bear on the work teachers do. Finding a place in the movement for educational reform is one way to exercise that larger caring. The four stages of a movement may help us find that place. Some of us may decide to live divided no more, to align our actions as teachers with the meaning we attach to our work. Some of us may seek others who share our values, joining communities of congruence that can sustain our transformation. Some of us may go public with our beliefs, voicing our vision and being challenged by the response. Some of us may learn that conventional rewards pale as we experience the satisfaction of living by our best lights. As we find our place in the movement, we will discover that there is no essential conflict between loving to teach and working to reform education. An authentic movement is not a play for power. It is teaching and learning writ large. Now the world becomes our classroom, and the potential to teach and learn is found everywhere. We need only be in the world as our true selves, with open hearts and minds. So we come full circle to the place where this book began. To the power within each of us that, in communion with powers beyond ourselves, co-creates the world for better or worse. The poet Rumi says, "If you are here unfaithfully with us, you're causing terrible damage." The evidence of this claim is all around us, not least in education. When we are unfaithful to the inward teacher and to the community of truth, we do lamentable damage to ourselves, to our students, and to the great things of the world that our knowledge holds in trust. But Rumi would surely agree that the converse is equally true. If you are here faithfully with us, you are bringing abundant blessing. It is a blessing known to generations of students whose lives have been transformed by people who had the courage to teach. The courage to teach from the most truthful places in the landscape of self and world. The courage to invite students to discover, explore, and inhabit those places in the living of their own lives. Afterword to the 10th Anniversary Edition. The New Professional, Education for Transformation. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark, for it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. William Stafford, A Ritual to Read to Each Other. The Movement Model in Action. In the decades since I finished the last chapter of The Courage to Teach, I have seen nothing to challenge its rough map of the way movements for social change unfold. More important, I have seen much to suggest that a movement toward taking seriously the inner landscape of a teacher's life has been gaining momentum. These claims may prove nothing more than my undying loyalty to my own ideas, But I believe there is solid evidence that a movement to reclaim the relevance of teachers and learners' inner lives has become more visible, credible, and compelling since 1997. Of course, this movement did not begin 10 years ago, and its history has, as history so doggedly does, refused to conform to any model of how it is supposed to unfold. As I said in the first edition of this book, regarding the four movement stages that I trace in Chapter 7, all of these stages are ideal types. They do not unfold as neatly as the model suggests. They overlap, circle back, and sometimes play leapfrog with each other. But by naming them, however abstractly, we can distill the essential dynamics of a movement from its chaotic energy field. Still, in the midst of history's messiness, it is possible to look back on the past decade and identify moments that signal a turning toward the kind of education envisioned in this book. For example, in September 1998, I shared the platform with teacher scholars from such diverse institutions as Amherst, Antioch, Columbia, Harvard, and the University of Southern California at a conference titled Education as Transformation, sponsored by Wellesley College, to explore issues of religious pluralism and spirituality in higher education. It seems likely that 10 or 20 years earlier, the sponsoring institution and many of those represented on the platform and in the audience would have been associated with this topic reluctantly, if at all. One educator at the conference said publicly what others were saying privately. "I came here because I knew that a movement was starting." As I delivered the keynote address to an audience of 800 people from 250 institutions, an audience that included presidents, faculty, administrators, students, religious life staff, and trustees, I sensed that her words were prophetic. In fact, this conference gave rise to a national organization called Education as Transformation that pursues the conference mission to this day. Conferences exploring the inner lives of teachers and learners are meaningful signs of a movement related to the themes of this book. But so many conferences have been held in recent years that a detailed listing, while proving the point, would also prove tedious. So I want to cite just two other national gatherings that mark new stages in the expansion and legitimation of this movement. In June 2000, a conference inspired by the Wellesley Gathering was held at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, sparked by then-Chancellor David Scott. Titled Going Public with Spirituality in Work and Higher Education, this gathering is worth noting because, unlike the Wellesley event, it was hosted by a tax-supported university that was willing to go public with spirituality in a way that such institutions have historically been loath to do. In February 2007, a conference titled Uncovering the Heart of Higher Education, Integrative Learning for Compassionate Action in an Interconnected World, drew over 600 people from 260 institutions to San Francisco. This one, whose sponsors included the Association of American Colleges and Universities, the Council of Independent Colleges, the League for Innovation in the Community College, and the Association of Student Personnel Administrators, is worthy of note because national associations of this sort do not align themselves with topics that their member institutions find unpalatable. Another significant sign that a movement is underway is the growing body of research and publications devoted to integrative teaching and learning, strong evidence that the national discourse on education is expanding to include inner life issues. 20 years ago, efforts to study the educational relevance of religion and spirituality would have been regarded as uncouth by most academics. It seems clear that a sea change is underway when a peer-reviewed publication called the Journal of College and Character, housed at a tax-supported university, attracts a wide readership with topical issues such as the one online as I write, Inward Journeys, Forms and Patterns of College Student Spirituality. It becomes clearer still that the tide is rising when Arthur W. Chickering, one of higher education's honored elders, serves as lead author of a book titled Encouraging Authenticity and Spirituality in Higher Education. And high tide cannot be far behind when the prestigious Higher Education Research Institute at UCLA conducts studies with titles like Spirituality and the Professoriate, a national study of faculty attitudes, experiences, and behaviors, and Spirituality in Higher Education, a national study of college students' search for meaning and purpose, whose principal investigators are the distinguished educational researchers Alexander W. Astin and Helen S. Astin. What does all this have to do with the elementary and secondary school educators whose reception of the first edition of this book has been so heartening to me? A great deal. Many reform efforts in higher and professional education involve problems that begin upstream and so require collaboration with educators who work the headwaters. The most thoughtful people at every level of education understand that we must transcend the artificial boundaries that separate us so we can collaborate in spirit and practice in order to serve students well. Over the past decade, K-12 education has paralleled higher education in the movement to create programs that support the teacher's inner life. This seems especially remarkable to me, given the fact that during the same decade, public education became dominated and driven by the federal legislation called No Child Left Behind, NCLB. This legislation has one vital and unassailable aim: to ensure that public education offers all children a chance to succeed at learning by holding educators accountable for their success. But NCLB is deeply flawed, not least because it is a set of unfunded mandates. In fact, it has occurred to me from time to time that NCLB is a scheme to create such massive failure in public education that privatization would become an appealing option to more Americans. And even if it were properly funded, NCLB is flawed in its single-minded focus on the kind of learning that can be measured by standardized tests. This, of course, marginalizes all subjects and skills that do not contribute to generating high test scores, including such useless subjects as music and art, and such useless skills as exploring questions that are not in the book and finding answers that are not in the teacher's guide. NCLB puts intense pressure on K-12 educators to teach to the test rather than to a student's true needs, and it often forces teachers into competition with each other. Individuals as well as their schools are penalized if their students fail by this legislation's simplistic standards. Not only does this undermine the relational trust that we know to be critical to student learning, even as measured by standardized tests, but it can also make teachers so frenetic, so self-absorbed, and so distrustful that no semblance of inner work alone or together is possible. So it is a wonder to me that in the increasingly toxic soil of public education, a seed involving inner work for K-12 educators has germinated, sunk roots, grown, and begun to flower in the decades since The Courage to Teach was published. In some places, the plants growing from that seed are helping to cleanse the soil of its toxicity. In the fall 2006 issue of the Educational Forum, Sam Intrator and Robert Kunzman survey and summarize 17 empirical studies on teacher renewal programming and its impact on educators conducted between 1997 and 2005, including several studies of participants in the Courage to Teach program. Attending to the teacher's inner life, they claim, has become an increasingly prominent topic on the agenda of public school teachers and administrators, as well as teacher educators. Writing that we still have much to learn about programming that supports the inner lives of teachers, Intrator and Kunzman go on to say that it seems increasingly clear that educators embrace the idea that teaching and leading must embody personal, spiritual, and emotional dimensions, as is evidenced by the popularity of recent works by Parker Palmer, 1998-2004, Margaret Wheatley, 2006, Lee Bowman and Terence Deal, 2001, and Andy Hargreaves and Michael Fullan, 1998. Many of these theorists advocate for professional development that attends to the inner dimensions of a teacher's life. Education journals have devoted special issues about the importance of wholehearted commitment to good teaching. For example, the January 1999 issue of Educational Leadership, which focused on spirituality in education, ranks as the journal's single most requested reprint. As author of the lead essay for that issue of Educational Leadership, I can testify, based on comments I continue to receive, that the topic of spirituality in education and the editor's even-handed treatment of it struck a deep chord with many people. A case study of institutional change. Conferences held, research conducted, and widespread publication of articles, journals, and books are decent evidence of a movement. But the most compelling evidence comes when leaders, positional and otherwise on the inside or on the outside, create force fields that challenge institutions to change. In the decades since The Courage to Teach was published, I have watched many such stories unfold, large and small. Here is one of the larger stories. In June 2000, I received a call from David Leach, a physician who is executive director of the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, ACGME. Based in Chicago with a staff of over 100, the ACGME monitors and accredits the more than 8,000 medical residency programs in this country, where physicians in training receive at least 3 years of supervised, on-the-job education before they become fully certified doctors of medicine. Dr. Leach told me that the ACGME was working with residency program educators to renew medical professionalism, or humanistic medical practice, which they define as follows. Residents must demonstrate a commitment to carrying out professional responsibilities, adherence to ethical principles, and sensitivity to a diverse patient population. Residents are expected to demonstrate respect, compassion, and integrity, a responsiveness to the needs of patients and society that supersedes self-interest, accountability to patients, society, and the profession, and a commitment to excellence and ongoing professional development. Demonstrate a commitment to ethical principles pertaining to provision or withholding of clinical care, confidentiality of patient information, informed consent, and business practices. Demonstrate sensitivity and responsiveness to patients' culture, age, gender, and disabilities. As the definition makes clear, medical professionalism depends heavily on the quality of a physician's inner life. Respect, compassion, integrity, sensitivity, and the transcendence of self-interest are not techniques. They are places where people can stand in the inner landscape of their own lives if they know how to get there. Dr. Leach said that he, his staff, and his board had studied The Courage to Teach and watched a 1998 talk I gave to a national conference of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, where I explored the movement model of social change as it relates to the reform of medicine. They were also aware, he told me, of what the Center for Courage and Renewal was doing with public school educators, helping them rejoin soul and role. The ACGME believed, said Dr. Leach, that our work could support their professionalism agenda by helping medical residents and their teachers reconnect with the convictions that led them to become physicians. In fact, he said, they were developing a plan to pursue all of this, a plan in which he hoped to involve me and my colleagues. After explaining the plan and answering my questions about it, he asked if I had any interest in talking about a collaboration. Well, let's see, I thought to myself. Here's a leader in medical education who seems compassionate, brilliant, and effective. His organization has authority over a critical part of medical education. He, his staff, and his board understand our work and have developed a workable plan of action backed by their own resources that links their agenda with ours. Is this really worth our time and energy? After considering these complexities for a full microsecond, I fairly shouted at Dr. Leach, "How soon can we begin?" From that conversation grew some working relationships and friendships that are among the most treasured of my professional and personal life. The ACGME plan, now in its 6th year of implementation, is the soul of simplicity and a stroke of genius. Each year since 2002, the ACGME has offered a high-profile Courage to Teach award to 10 residency program directors who have excelled in their roles as teacher, coach, mentor, parent, Dutch uncle, and the myriad other parts a successful program director must play. Directors whose programs offer exemplary support for medical professionalism. Nominations for the award are solicited from all members of the ACGME community. After a winnowing by staff, the 10 recipients are chosen by the ACGME board, publicized in its bulletin, honored at a banquet in Chicago, and brought together in a Courage to Teach retreat, whose facilitators are physicians trained by the Center for Courage and Renewal. At each retreat, previous awardees are folded into the current crop, and at national ACGME gatherings, award winners gather for conversations that fuel the movement. I have seen many Teacher of the Year award programs. As a rule, they give worthy educators the praise that is their due, but have little or no institutional impact. The ACGME award program is different. Its ultimate purpose is not simply to honor 10 medical educators each year. The ACGME is parlaying this program into a deepening dialogue about medical professionalism intended to help transform residency education. Through its Courage to Teach awards, this accrediting agency is building support for the evolution of a new set of accreditation standards that will require all 8,000 residency programs to embrace new standards for professionalism in medicine. As the chair of the ACGME board wrote in the 2002-2003 annual report, "All of our work is intended to lead us toward what Dr. Leach calls the accreditation system after next, one much more focused on outcomes and much less on process." Outcomes refers to the development of professional behavior in students. For too long, educational accreditation has focused on a school's inputs to the educational process. How many courses are taught, the percentage of faculty with terminal degrees, the number of books in the library, and the like. As if what a school offered its students were a measure of its graduates' capacities. I tell the ACGME story in part to offer more evidence that concern about inner life issues in education is helping drive efforts at major institutional reform. David Leach and his colleagues understand that faculty who teach medical students cannot encourage professionalism in them without attending to the inner landscape of their own lives as teachers. And I tell this story for another reason as well. Medicine is new territory for me, and exploring it, with wise guides like Dr. Leach and Dr. Paul Batalden, has helped me think new thoughts. Among other things, my work with the ACGME has taken me beyond the generalities of the movement model, abstractions that are its strength as well as its weakness, toward a more focused agenda for change that I call the education of a new professional. Our need for a new professional. In spring 2002, at the first ACGME Courage to Teach retreat, we worked with a case study of a breakdown in healthcare that had resulted in the avoidable death of an organ donor. Because this death involved the actions or inaction of a medical resident, the case could also be read as a breakdown in residency education. The case is, of course, full of medicine-specific details, but it vividly illustrates a crisis in every profession. From medicine to teaching to the ministry to the law, the very institutions in which we practice our crafts pose some of the gravest threats to professional standards and personal integrity. Yet higher education does little, if anything, to prepare students to confront, challenge, and help change the institutional conditions under which they will soon be working. Please hold that thesis in mind and reflect on parallels in your own field as I spell out the facts of this case, facts that are clinical, spare, and haunting. On January 10, 2002, a healthy 57-year-old man underwent a liver donation procedure that successfully resected approximately 60% of the right lobe of his liver in preparation for transplanting that liver into his brother, a 54-year-old man who suffered from a degenerative liver disease. After what was described as a technically uneventful transplant, the donor patient seemed to do well on the first postoperative day. He began to manifest some tachycardia, abnormally rapid heartbeat, late on the second postoperative day. Early on the third postoperative day, he began to hiccup and complained of being nauseated. He was given symptomatic treatment. Later that day, he began to vomit brownish material. He became oxygen desaturated, lacking adequate oxygen in the bloodstream, and was placed on 100% oxygen by mask. He was pronounced dead on the third postoperative day. 3 months later, the state health commissioner issued an incident report that said the hospital allowed this patient to undergo a major high-risk procedure and then left his post-operative care in the hands of an overburdened, mostly junior staff without appropriate supervision. Supervision of medical residents was far too lax, resulting in woefully inadequate post-surgical care. I do not doubt that the hospital, inadequate staffing, inexperience, and lax supervision are all to blame. I do not doubt the importance of identifying and fixing these system problems, but I am struck by the abstract, impersonal quality of this language, as if no one involved had a name. This analysis assigns culpability not to people but to nouns, the hospital, staffing, inexperience, and supervision.